Hi there, Gemma here. If you're enjoying our podcast, then please do come along and put your name down on the wait list for our Schema Circle. And that way you'll hear when we next open the doors for new members to join. The Schema Circle is really our passion project, and it's our online schema coaching membership program. There's nothing really quite like it. It's new and innovative, and we just love it. Now, there's a huge library of content waiting for you already inside. We also continue to do 3 live Q&A coaching calls every month. Now, everything is recorded, of course, and ready for you to view at your own pace. If you're looking for, a unique way to understand yourself better and to make real change, then I do invite you to come and have a look. Go to theredflagproject.com.au/SC. Now, the Schema Circle isn't therapy, but it's a great accompaniment to your own therapy journey. It's also a great resource for therapists and coaches and for anybody, men and women, wanting to know more about schemas and how we can use this fantastic model to empower ourselves to make actual changes, the changes we want in our life. Now, it's currently housed on our Red Flag website, and just click the link below to read all about it. I hope to see you inside one day. Thanks for joining us at the Good Mood Clinic podcast, where we get to the heart of the matter about what makes us humans tick. We're Justine Corrie and Gemma Gladstone, 2 clinical psychologists and schema therapists, and we're passionate about helping you break unwanted life patterns and finding new ways to understand yourself and those tricky people around you. Life is way too short to be derailed by our schemas, by self-sabotage, toxic relationships, or a lack of self-worth. So let's tackle this together and help you reclaim your life and who you really are. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Good Mood Clinic podcast. My name is Gemma Gladstone, and I am usually coming to you with my colleague, Justine Corrie. But today I'm going to do a solo show for you. And I'm going to be talking about something that has come out of lockdown a little bit and have been having a couple more face-to-face conversations with some of my clients. I've just been struck this last week with a theme that people have been discussing. And that's all around the idea of the inner critic. And I just want to use this opportunity today while I'm on my own to just do a little bit of a teaching episode around what is this thing and how do we view it in schema therapy and how can we try to understand it. So for those of you who don't know me, like I said, my name's Gemma Gladstone. I'm a psychologist and a schema therapist. I'm a certified schema therapist, supervisor, and trainer. And that means not only am I certified in practicing schema therapy, but also in training others in schema therapy and also providing supervision. And, for a lot, I've been in private practice really since 2001. I've done other things alongside my private practice and ebbed and flowed and in different directions. So, I've come across a lot of people in those years. Something that's always struck me is that we all tend to have a bit of this. We all tend to have some degree of what we might call an inner critic. Now, it's pretty common. Some of us are really more aware of it than others. Some people don't really acknowledge or feel like they have a critical part of them that talks to them, or whether it's their own voice or you kind of sense you're hearing another voice inside your head. But normally a critic is, it doesn't have to be an ongoing narrative, a really deliberate narrative in your head, but it just can be a collection of thoughts, automatic thoughts, things you would just think about. Maybe it's things you say to yourself out loud. And, one of the reasons why I love schema therapy so much and working with people looking, through the schema therapy lens is because we have some really great language for understanding the inner critic. And we can pull it apart a little bit, actually, and not just collapse it into one type of critic or critical voice, but I think personally it helps to, so other people have viewed it like this, and I agree, it helps to pull it apart a little bit and see what are the different types of critics, because some of them might have different functions. So I'm just going to be talking about the inner critic today, and you can get a sense of whether you identify with this and if so, which one. And so in schema therapy, we do like to pull apart the inner critic and look at its function and look at, okay, when does it come up? When is it loudest? When is it most activated? What would trigger the critic or the, you know, your critical voice? And what are the kind of messages of the critic? Can the critic ever be helpful, for example? Or is the critic always just a destructive force? And, you know, is the critic, for example, does the critic come from a specific person? So if someone is aware that they have an inner critic, is it really the voice of their mother in their head or their father or a caretaker? Or is it an amalgamation, a conglomerate of different experiences that they had in their formative years? Is that their critic? So the critic can, you know, come in all shapes and sizes, and it might be quite unique. And so sometimes when we are in critic mode, we might be avoiding doing something because it's easier to engage with our critic than to actually lean into an emotion, for example. And some people will have a really persistent critic. You know, I've met a lot of people who have had really difficult to shift depression. And often if a person has very persistent chronic depression or recurrent depression, it's not uncommon for them to have quite a strong critic, but quite a detrimental in schema therapy and schema speech, we might call this a punitive critic. So to couch it back into schema therapy, originally we had the schema model, right? Where Justine and I have spoken about it before. Jeffrey Young, the developer and founder of schema therapy, and then many people have jumped on it and elaborated it. And his initial self-help book, if you haven't already checked that out, if you haven't got yourself a copy, it's a great starter, and it's called Reinventing Your Life. And that's in the show notes. We pretty much have that in the show notes every time. But the critic started gaining mention in schema therapy more when the mode model was developed. And in schema therapy, we have these different modes or parts of self. So we can think of modes as a combination of, you know, when a schema might be triggered, say an abandonment schema gets triggered, right? And then how we respond to that schema. So an abandonment schema might get triggered by you send texts to your friend and your friend hasn't answered you. And then you find yourself getting really angry, and then you actually have a bit of a dummy spit to your friend on the phone later on. Well, that would be a combination of feeling abandoned and then reacting to that abandoned feeling in a certain way, in a kind of counterproductive, overcompensating way. And you might flip into like a bit of an angry child mode. So we talk about modes often in schema therapy as sort of a combination of our schemas, the core belief stuff, and how we respond to it, particularly when we're talking about coping modes. But I'm not going to break down everything about modes today. I just want to say that in schema therapy, originally in the mode model, there was also talk about what they called parent modes, the punitive parent mode or the demanding parent mode. In other words, the inner critic. In schema therapy, it's classically referred to parent modes, but sometimes it's easier just to think about it as critic modes, because these parent modes are not like how you are as a parent, and they're not necessarily straight down the line related to how you were parented, but they're more referring to interjected learning, things that we've learnt either directly or indirectly, about ourselves, the messages that we've internalized, and then that's become our sort of inner monologue, our self-critical thinking, if you like. And in schema therapy, that was called the parent modes. So I'm just going to be referring to it as the critic mode because it's a little bit easier just to, I think, just grasp and, you know, apply. So that's really a bit of a long-winded introduction to the inner critic. And, of course, schema therapy is not the only model or, you know, the only group of people that talk about the inner critic. You know, it's been around since forever, right? Many schools of thought and also traditions have been aware that because we're humans, you know, we have a fairly sophisticated brain, well, most of us anyway, and our brain is prone to wander. And that's the nature of the human mind. So we're really fighting against our biology when we try to do things like taming our critic, for example, because through our own devices, humans, you know, we're our own worst enemy. Left to our own devices, we will ruminate, we'll worry, our mind will always be going to the past and or the future, you know. So our mind will always be going to the, oh gosh, why did I do that? If only I'd done this, or if only that hadn't happened, and if only this had happened instead, and all of that kind of stuff. And then we move to the future and think, well, what if this happens, and how will I cope when that happens, and what if I don't cope when this happens, and what if this thing happens? And, you know, and that causes us a lot of anxiety, particularly future-orientated kind of worry. And, you know, rumination on the past can often feed into depression, you know, depressed mood states. We are indeed a very, very, very worrying animal, us humans. And because we can forecast and plan and think about things, and we can multitask and we can think about a number of things at once, and we can think about the future, that's a positive thing, but it's also to our detriment because we are very much inclined to just to be worrying animals and to engage with our mental content. This is why things like mindfulness and mindfulness meditation and mindfulness training is so helpful, because it gets us to have a look at, you know, and change the relationship we have with all this mental stuff, right? Change our relationship so that we're more aware of what we're doing when we're doing it. You know, if you've probably all had that experience where you get in your car or however your mode of transport is, and you're going from A to B, and you leave A and you get to B, and you don't even remember how you got there, because one part of your brain has been on autopilot and the other part has just been off, you know, with the pixies somewhere, worrying about what happened yesterday, or thinking about a mistake you made in the past, or thinking about if only you had made this other decision. And so we can't help ourselves. We're engaging in mental cognitive processing all of the time. And invariably, we go toward the negative. You know, some people in psychology call this the default mechanism, where we just sort of left to our own devices. If we're silent and if we attempt to meditate and we let our mind wander, for example, say, we'll often go to the negative. If you leave two people alone having a conversation for long enough, invariably they'll often get to a negative topic. You know, we can't help it. We're creatures of habit. This is our brain. This is the curse of a sophisticated brain. We worry, we ruminate, we forecast, and we scare ourselves. We scare ourselves a lot. Self-created fear and scare tactics is what we do, you know, as humans when we're thinking about stuff. With you talking about mindfulness, you know, mindfulness, you'll all be aware of that by now, you know, is coming at least from the Buddhist tradition, you know, very helpful form of just retraining the mind so you can gain some, just some subtle mastery over what your mind is doing. So it's an increased awareness of what am I doing right now with my thinking? Where is my mind? You know, where is my focus? I'm having a beautiful walk in the park, yet I've just realized that for the last 10 minutes, I've been worrying about a conversation I had with a work colleague. I'm noticing that my heart is racing, not from the walking, but from the whole cortisol and the hormones that I'm producing just by thinking about this stressful event. So us humans, we are often constantly engaged with not only the world around us and what's actually happening externally and what's happening interrelatedly with when we converse with people, but also what is happening internally, mentally for us. And sometimes it is exhausting, isn't it? It's totally and utterly exhausting. So if you're having benign thoughts or compassionate thoughts or encouraging thoughts, and you know, that's a little bit easier to handle. But if you're having, you know, guilty thoughts, or if you're having very fear-based thoughts, or if you're having very sort of anxious, pressured thoughts, these are all stressful. And I'm just going to break down for you, we're going to look at the inner critic. Now, what do I mean when I'm talking about the inner critic? So intuitively, I think we all sort of know what we mean. And it, like I said, it comes in many different forms for different people. It may not be a super, you know, consciously aware thing that we're doing on tension and on purpose. Sometimes these might just be automatic thoughts that just pop up, or they come secondary to an emotion, for example, where we feel sad or we feel fearful, and then we'll have a whole array of thoughts that match that as well. But when we're talking about as human beings, the negative self-talk or the inner critic, it's good to remind ourselves that we weren't born with these thoughts. I know that sounds a bit crazy. Of course we weren't, you say. But it's very good to remind ourselves that we weren't actually born with these thoughts. They're not inherent to us. These thoughts, they are stories. They are stories that we have learnt from somewhere else. They're not inherent to us. They're not attached to our soul, if you talk about souls. They're not a part of our higher consciousness or our essence as a human being or a spiritual being living in a human body, no matter whatever way you want to put the framework on it. They're simply stories. They're simply a whole bunch of narration or automatic thoughts or justifications or stories that we tell ourselves because they're familiar, because we either heard them repeatedly or we inferred them from our environment. And so they're very, very much learned. They are the product of other people's schemas, in fact. They are the product of other people's psyche or personality problems or disorders. They are a product of other people's treatment of us. And because when we're children, we go through phases where we're really black and white. We can tend to be, depending on our age, concrete thinkers. We tend to take things literally. So it's really, we're like sponges when we're children, right? Children, mentally, emotionally, psychologically, is like a sponge, sucking in and drawing up and taking in and ingesting all of the messages that surround us, either directly like what mum told us or what dad told us, or what we're learning from the relationship modeled to us by our parents or early experiences at school, or the bullying that we had, for example, at school, or the way we were picked on by, you know, a teacher at school, or feeling really left out and not included, you know, coming from a different country and feeling isolated and not fitting in easily to a peer group at school. Now, you know, there's so many different types of origins and just hearing messages, hearing your mother say a certain phrase over and over again, or your father say a certain phrase over and over again, all these things. So in essence, our critic, the stuff that you torment yourself with, is not yours. It didn't come from you. You weren't born with it. You learnt it. You learnt it. Layer upon layer upon layer. And effectively, you can unlearn it. It's really, you might say, well, that's completely obvious. Of course, I wasn't born with it. I was an infant. You know, I wasn't born with the dialogue, you know, thinking I'm stupid, I'm worthless. But these messages are things that we might have heard, and not even as harsh as that. You might have been unfavorably compared to a sibling, for example. And you might have heard that message over and over again, harmless enough, like, oh, you know, if only you could just complete all your homework like your sister. She doesn't have any struggle with the homework. Why are you struggling so much with your homework? Well, if you hear that 5,000 times, then it's probably having an imprint. Parents don't mean to create this half the time. The majority of parents don't go out to create a destructive inner critic in their children. I mean, I have had clients over the years where I would have to say, yes, their parents have. They have had that malevolent streak, unfortunately. So, you know, that does happen. But in the vast majority of cases, our schemas are developed and learned, and schemas are created by learning of things a little bit more insidious, not by extreme, horrific one-off events, usually, although they are too, that they're still traumas, of course. But, you know, it's more insidious, you know, learning where we sort of learnt through modelling, or, you know, we learnt that every time mum made a mistake, she would say to herself, oh, God, I'm a fool. Why am I doing this? You know, I'm hopeless. I wish I had a brain. Right? You hear that long enough and you're going to have feelings and thoughts about that. If you were told from a very early age, you know, you're the eldest boy here and you've got to take care of your mother. Now, try to make sure she's happy, and I don't want anything to upset her because she's been sick, and, you know, I want you to keep everyone else in line, and I want you to, you know, take care of your mum. Mum isn't so great, and then you end up feeling a terrible sense of burden and responsibility because you haven't kept your end of the bargain. So messages that are subtle and not so subtle and unmet needs, not having our core emotional needs met, these are how schemas are created. For the defectiveness schema, for example, which is one of the core schemas, often underpins the critic, right? The defectiveness schema being feeling at my core like something is wrong with me. I'm not right. You know, other people are fine, but I'm flawed in somehow. I'm just no good. I'm faulty. There is something inherently wrong with me. Well, if you weren't actually shown any love or care or nurturing, or you weren't attuned to in any way, and if you did express yourself, you were told that, oh, look, you don't have anything to say, be quiet, be seen and not heard, and be seen and not heard, and preferably not even seen. You know, if you had that kind of message, well, you're going to grow up thinking, well, I've got nothing to contribute, and at the core of me, there's something wrong. Schemas, just to remind you, you know, schemas develop these core beliefs, deeply held core beliefs, and, you know, schemas are a lot more than that. But they develop very early, and they develop from ongoing learning experiences. We can still be hurt by people who love us, you know? So you can have a parent who loves you deeply, and they can still be very wounding because of their own stuff. And I'm sure you know what I mean. What are these inner critic modes, or sometimes called parent modes, in schema therapy? Well, let's think about it. We can think about the inner critic as hosting this set of like stable negative beliefs or negative ideas about ourselves, which worsen when we're triggered by some sort of external or internal factor, such as, for example, learning that you don't get a great mark on your uni exam, or getting some negative feedback from your boss, or going out on a date and you thought it went well and then you never hear from the person again. could give rise to all sorts of self-talk. And depending on your early experiences, then that self-talk is going to be more harsh or a little bit more moderate, depending on where you've been and what's happened to you in your life. Or, for example, you know, you can't help your friend, but you really, really want to. You want to be there for your friend, but, you know, you've just got a terrible cold, or you've just, you know, you've got the flu, you feel awful, and you run down, you've really got to take some time off to rest, and you just can't be there at their thing that they really wanted you to go to. And so you feel guilty. And then you might have a critic part saying, oh, you know, what kind of a friend are you? You've got to show up. You might lose this friend if you don't show up. Have you thought about that? You can, you know, the critic might come in the first person, or you might be speaking in the third person. It just depends. So how do we break it down? And the reason why I think it's useful to break down the inner critic, and I think that schema therapy and some people in schema therapy looking at these apparent critic modes have done a lot of work in differentiating the critic. And I think I like that. I like the way schema therapy differentiates the critic into different parts and different elements. Hello, lovely listeners. I hope you're enjoying the episode so far. It's Gemma Gladstone here, and I want to let you know a little bit more about the Red Flag Project. It's an online course for women which provides you with a dating strategy designed to help you understand why you've ended up in relationships with men who have been emotionally unavailable or narcissistic. In the course, we'll help you begin to break this pattern and to really understand what's going on underneath it all. We'll teach you about all the actual red flags to watch out for and give you lots of practical advice and strategies. It will be life-changing if you let it. Just click on The Red Flag Project in the show notes below for this episode to get all the info. Now let's get back to the show. The first kind of critic I want to mention is the kind that we really think of when we think about a harsh inner critic. Now, this is not the norm, but I suppose it would be like 20-25% of my caseload, for example, of clients at any given time who might have a very, very, what I call really toxic inner critic. And in schema therapy, we kind of call this the punitive critic. And this is the way they think about themselves is really destructive. They'll say things like, look, at the end of the day, I am just a total and utter worthless failure. And I don't care how much you try to convince me otherwise, Gemma, that I'm not. I just am. Okay. There's a little of evidence to support it. And like, that's just what I am. So don't even try to go there. I know this because, you know, my friends leave me and my parents hated me. If I was lovable, my father wouldn't have left when I was four. And, you know, my mother wouldn't have started drinking. My parents would have loved me and cared enough to be around me. And they would have been there. Therefore, it's proof that I'm pretty much flawed. I'm pretty much unlovable. I don't believe I'm worthy of love. And if bad stuff happens to me, well, you know, who cares? I'm not saying that kind of thinking is common, but it is there. And like at any given time, I might have a quarter of people that I'm working with might have this kind of critic. Now, this kind of critic is of absolutely no value, okay? There is no value to this critic. This critic is not trying to help you in any possible way, shape, or form. This critic is not scared of anything in any way, shape, or form. This critic here is the genesis of this particular critic. The origins are usually fairly extreme, and it usually comes out of an environment where the client was abused or mistreated. There was often psychological and verbal and emotional abuse as well, plus or minus other forms of physical or sexual abuse. So there often is an origin where, you know, there was nasty stuff going on, where the client had their sense of, you know, self eroded, sometimes intentionally. They really received really noxious messages, and or they were completely neglected and they were given not so much direct verbal messages or of you're hopeless, why did I ever have you, I wish you were never born, not extreme like that, but they may have been given indirect messages of like, of just you're not lovable because they didn't receive any love. They didn't have anybody. They didn't have any soft place to fall. They didn't have any warm maternal or paternal foundations in which to feel safe. They were criticized. You know, they were neglected. So a punitive, a really harsh, harsh punitive critic that says things like, look, you're worthless, or I'm worthless. I'm hopeless. Or, you know, I'm a real piece of shit. This is highly correlated with a subset of people who have a real trouble recovering from chronic or recurrent episodes of depression, coupled with other types of modes that block therapy. The person will often have this kind of critic. So, you know, this critic can be chipped away at slowly. You know, it can happen. It can happen through encouraging very slowly the person to develop an alternative, compassionate, healthy adult voice that is kind and moderate. And as the therapist, it's our job to provide that alternative voice. But it's not going to happen overnight, but it can happen. And that's why things like we do in schema therapy, we do a lot of experiential stuff like chair work. We do things like imagery, re-scripting, and we can give alternative messages that contradict the critic at the level of when those thoughts were laid down or to the part of self that really feels that and believes that. So that's the great thing about schema therapy because it's so integrative, you know, and we're using all sorts of different types of interventions to get maximum benefit. So yeah, the punitive critic can be a hard one and a tough one, and it tends to be pretty robust, but it wasn't there when you were born. You learned it, and it can be slowly but surely. And hey, it doesn't even have to be that slowly, because with experiential interventions, we can make a big impact in a relatively short amount of time. You know, I'm not talking about sitting and intellectually talking about the critic for 2 or 3 years. I'm talking about doing things that really get underneath and shake the foundations of that critic. And we can do that in the context of therapy or coaching when we're trying to work on these kind of fairly often treatment resistant, you know, critical parts of us, but it's just a part. But the thing with this kind of critic is it's always there. You know, you make a mistake at work, there it is. You take a risk in your love life and it fails, there's the critic up again saying, oh, you'll never meet anybody, you're worthless. Or you try to do something creative, you go to an art class and you know, the teacher didn't pick out yours and say, well done. She just kind of walked past. That's the critic again. You've never been able to paint. I don't know why you're even trying. You're hopeless and you've never been, you don't have a creative bone in your body, right? So the punitive critic is pervasive and will find opportunities to come up. Just say you're trying to lose weight, you're doing a new eating plan or whatever, and okay, you ate that pizza or you indulged in that birthday cake. There's the critic. Pop up again. You're always going to be fat. You know, don't even bother. You're hopeless. You've got no willpower. Et cetera, et cetera. You know the way it goes, right? That's that familiar negative voice. Oh, it's so boring. And after a while, you can start to get more and more distance from the critic, right? And it helps. You need alternative messages. You know, you're not just going to wake up one day and the critic's gone. You need help with this. You need alternative messages. So, you know, that's the punitive critic. And that critic is of no value to you, okay? So what that critic needs to be done, you know, doing is just slowly but surely, you know, silenced, and it still may pop up now and again, and it's probably always going to just be there to it. But we can reduce it from about 90%. Good schema therapy and schema coaching, we can get that down, you know, to probably like 20% or maybe even 10%. where it comes up every now and again, but you know how to handle it, or you're more distanced from it. You've got sort of a sense of diffusion from it. You can say, oh, there's that critic again. Okay, yeah, I know. I know what you're on about. Just you're boring me. I'm not going to listen to you. I'm going to listen to this. And so, you know, and I'm going to tune into my sort of compassionate side, my healthy adult side, the side that actually, you know, cares about me, the own inner coach that you're developing. That's the punitive critic. Not really any room for it in your life. It can be really robust and tricky to shift, and it can pop up, and it can be so automatic, and you're not alone. If that's you, you're not alone, because there's a lot of people that have this kind of critic, and maybe you're just saying, well, I don't really relate to that kind of critic. You know, maybe your critic is of a sort of a different fashion. Maybe it looks a little bit different or feels a little bit differently. You know, people that have a core defectiveness schema, so that feel like their self-worth is very tenuous, they tend to have a punitive critic. Maybe it's not there all the time, but it will surface when the conditions allow it to surface. It's all about relearning the messages that you received, whether they were direct or indirect messages or inferences, or whether they were things that were modeled to you. And you learnt them because you saw interactions over and over again. They've all been learned. They're all stories. So, but, you know, if you do have a strong punitive critic, you really would be best to get some help with it from a person who works in this way, so they can help you identify what that critic is actually doing and how pervasive it is and when it pops up. And to help you slowly to get some distance from it and dilute it. Because that's the aim. It's what we want to do. We want to dilute it. We may never get it to fully shut up, but we might go a long way. And the more alternative messages we've put in there, like meaningful, really meaningful alternative messages, like developing a sense of healthy self-compassion at a trait level from the bottom up. And that involves getting to the part of you deep down, who originally heard these messages. And that's the beauty of schema therapy, because we work in the ways of separating us. We're just not one unified personality aspect of ourselves, but we have multiple sides, multiple aspects, multiple parts. We often refer to them as modes in schema therapy. Okay, so what have people in the schema community also said about the inner critic is that we can have a kind of critic that falls under the banner of the demanding parent mode or the demanding critic. Now, why do we want to identify if we've got a demanding critic? So, look, we can have both. We could have a punitive critic and we could have a demanding critic. We tend to have either, you know, if we have a lot of demanding critic, we mightn't have a punitive critic, or we might have both. But very often people will just have more of the demanding type of critic rather than the really, really, really malignant, nasty punitive critic. They may not have that, or maybe they only have that little bit. So what's a demanding critic? Well, if you can imagine demanding, pressure, demands, high standards, perfectionistic mindset, you know, a lot of shoulds, a lot of musts, a lot of burden, a lot of you should do this, you must do that. In order for me to be okay, I have to do X, Y, and Z, and I have to do it pretty well or perfectly. It's not good enough that I just do that or that. I have to do that and that and that. So the demanding critic pushes us, right? Now we might have a little bit of maybe a small amount can drive us. You know, everyone's different. But really, it's also a critic mode. So it's usually not helpful because it fuels, say, for example, the unrelenting standard schema, which is this idea that you have internally set yourself huge standards. You're always trying to prove essentially that you are good enough, that you are okay. So you, and if you surrender to that schema, then you do things like you're a workaholic. You don't just do 100%, you do 150%. Do everyone else's work for them. You expect high things from yourself and you're unrelenting in that. And you can also expect very high standards for others as well. You know, this is a problem because, you know, the higher our perfectionism is one of the big personality risk factors for depression. And so we've got to get on top of it. What is your demanding critic saying to you? Now, often the demanding critic is very fear-based, okay? It can be very fear-based. For example, you might have been told that, come on, you've got to do this homework. Come on, do it again. You made a mistake here. Let's correct it. Come on, come on, come on. And, you know, perhaps that was the parenting style that you were raised in. Or perhaps it was like, look, you're not going to get anywhere. You're not going to get anywhere in life if you don't excel. I had all these problems excelling and I was only taken seriously when I excelled. So you've got to excel too. A high demanding critic is akin to a lot of perfectionistic thoughts, right? I've got to do this. I've got to reach this goal. It's not okay that I only do mediocre. Getting credits at uni or passes or even distinctions are not okay. I've got to get HDs. I've got to get higher distinctions. Often the motivating driver is fear. If I don't get this standard, then something bad will happen or I won't get what I need in life. If I don't do this and present myself in a certain way and look perfect or have the perfect body or something, you know, I won't meet a partner. Or, you know, if I don't finish this particular university degree at this certain level, I won't get a job and therefore I won't be able to make a living and therefore I won't have enough money to survive. You know, so there is fear underneath the critic. Often, you know, there can be a lot of anxiety. So a parent that's really very anxious for their child might be critical and the criticism might be fear-based, but it's coming out in a harsh, critical way. But the parent might be actually petrified. And so, you know, sometimes the demanding critic has that function of potential protection or stopping something, a negative outcome from eventuating. Like, for example, if I don't get this, I won't get this job and then I won't have these opportunities and then I'll have nothing. You know, it's usually catastrophic, of course, the thinking, and exaggerated and quite catastrophic, but that's usually how it kind of goes. Or if I don't lose this weight, I won't meet a partner. And then, you know, if I won't meet a partner, I won't have this and I won't become a parent. And then if I don't do that, then I'll be, you know, I'll end up old and alone. Fear-based but catastrophic thought process. Fear is not a great motivator. What's a better motivator is encouragement, you know, self-compassion, self-care, wanting the best for us, ourselves, wanting to alleviate our suffering, wanting good things for ourselves rather than always being driven by fear, fear, fear. So in schema therapy, if we have a strong demanding critic, sometimes we can moderate this critic. You know, we can take the good out and get rid of the bad. So the demanding critic might be just trying to help the person, but get something, a need met or achieve an outcome, but it's just overshooting the mark and it's gone off the rails. So we have to try to, you know, understand this critic a little bit. What's its function? What's its purpose? Is it well-intended? Sometimes this critic may be well-intended. And if it is, we want to recognize that. Oh, I know you want to help me, but, you know, forcing me to go to the gym 7 days a week and staying there for an hour, but I think that might be a bit excessive. You know, I know you want to help me, so maybe we could just modify that down a bit and, you know, turn that into walking every day and going to the gym twice a week. So the critic is often, the demanding critic is there because it wants you to get something and it's afraid you won't. And so it hammers you for it. It gets in there. It's unrelenting. So with your therapist or schema therapist or with the therapy and the coaching we do, we try to pull apart, you know, the different types of critics and look at, okay, can we take any good stuff from the critic or not? So I would say from the punitive critic, no, there's no good stuff. We've got a different mode of working with that one. But with a demanding critic, maybe we can soften it. Maybe we can rejig it a little bit. Maybe we can pull out some of the good stuff and see if it can actually be an advocate, an ally, rather than the demanding. Because also, you know, if we have a strong demanding critic, we probably have a lot of I musts. I musts. I should. I have to. Oh my gosh. Can you feel how heavy it is when you say that to yourself? It's heavy. They're heavy words. They're heavy phrases. And it's usually because we've set our sights on this, but we don't really want to do it anyway. It's not lighting us up. It's not bringing us joy, but we think we have to. So it can be rigid, that demanding critic. It can be rigid. A number of paths we can take, a number of avenues to get to an outcome we want. There's not only one way to go. So this is where we need to bring in flexibility, because the demanding critic can be pretty rigid. You must do this. You must do that. And the only way to get there is to do that, that, and that. And you have to do that perfectly. Well, but that's a lot of pressure. So it's very anxiety. You know, we try to not lean into the anxiety by believing the critic, believing the demanding critic and doing everything it says. Fully surrendering to the demanding critic is fully surrendering to your perfectionism. Go, go, go. Work, work, work. Always, you know, perseverating. Always maybe too much thinking and not enough kind of leaning into, I don't know, your own creativity, thinking about what actually really lights you up. So flexibility and creativity and free flowing self-expression is often the antidote to the demanding critic. And, you know, trying to moderate or modify the critic, can we help it? Can we turn it into an ally rather than, you know, a tyrannical slave master? You know, can we turn it into somebody, some part of us that's going to be helpful rather than constantly pushing us? Because if we have that, well, we're going to burn out. That will be the end. The third kind of critic I want to let you know about is sometimes a little bit harder to identify. We don't even know we've got it. And some people in the schema community, and I like this because I see a lot in my clients, particularly with a lot of other directed people. So therefore people with big self-sacrifices, people who are subjugated, they feel they can't express themselves or they're doing things out of guilt. This is the guilt-inducing parent mode or the guilt-inducing critic, we'll call it. This is, can be also fear-based, right? But it's just that tad more manipulative, enmeshed with you and blaming. So it typically will come out of early experiences with caretakers where you were made to feel, directly or indirectly, responsible for people for whom you cared for, whether it was a mother, often, or a sibling, but you were made to feel responsible for them. You had to look after them. You had to hold back your needs because this person was somehow more pressing. Their needs were more pressing. So maybe it was modeled. Maybe your mother was a real self-sacrificer. She took care of everyone else and she ignored herself. And then she brought you in on it too. So you know, she taught you the same ways inadvertently, not wanting to hurt you, but she taught you the same ways. She neglected herself and put herself last perpetually and only looked after other people and made sure that their needs were met and their voice was expressed and their feelings were taken care of, all the while subjugating her own needs and thoughts and feelings and desires and dreams and goals and whatever else. You know, this guilt-inducing critic often comes from a parent who modeled their role as a servant to others. I am here to serve others, or I am so damn grateful that someone is here taking care of me, that they're so good to be doing that, that I'm just going to shut up and I'm never going to ask for anything. You know, that kind of learning. Or the other way, which is a little bit more manipulative, the manipulative way is, of course, if you were raised perhaps by a covert narcissist, for example, someone who was more internally narcissistic. They weren't kind of grandiose on the outside, but they were deeply self-absorbed and they tried to guilt trip you. So they were more overtly sending out a guilt message and you were picking it up because you were a sponge, of course, because you're a child, right? Because all children are sponges and that's where we pick stuff up. So your parent, your mum, your dad or someone else integral to, you know, your family and your development, your close attachment figure was somehow giving you the message that I'd rather you didn't look after yourself. I'd rather you poured everything into me. Or maybe when you didn't pay them enough attention, they gave you the cold shoulder. That one, right? They ignored you. They weren't there for you, all right? They gave more attention to your brother or your sister, for example. If you weren't playing their game, they sort of like gave you the cold shoulder, you know, which is a really destructive interpersonal style and coping response. Many people do that. You don't have to be very narcissistic to do that, but it's not a very advanced coping strategy. So you don't get your own way, so you ignore the other person. So the child feels guilty, all right? Or, for example, you know, dad says, look, take care of mum. Come on, you kids. Mum's not well. I don't want to hear a peep out of you kids. And I want you to just be tiptoe. I just don't even want to see you. So they have to suppress and subjugate, you know, and they feel bad if they want to go up to mum and say, mum, can you help me with this? Because they don't want to upset her. They don't want to make her more depressed or more sick or whatever it might be. So you can get guilt inducement that way. Or, for example, you know, you bring home a test score when you're a child or your report card and you don't do so well or you only get a B instead of an A for something. Yeah, your parents don't look so impressed. They go, oh dear. And then because of whatever's going on with them, maybe it sparked internal shame in them, they withdraw some affection from you. Maybe they don't attend to you so much. Maybe they're punishing you. In other words, someone is doing something to you, intentionally or not. Often it's intentional in these examples I'm giving here, where they're trying to make you feel something. They're manipulating your emotions. They're trying to change the way you are feeling. Oh, mum, you know, when you get your independence, can I go to this party? Can I have a sleepover at such and such a place? Can I go to the school camp? And dad says, because he's lonely or mum's lonely, you know, or whatever. Or maybe you're the third person in the family, so you stop them fighting or whatever function you serve in the family. And they say, you can go, but I'd rather you wouldn't. Look, it's your choice. You know, you do what's right for you. But, you make your mind up, you know. And, of course, if you're a child who's not that sensitive and it's water off a duck's back and you've been gifted with a more, you know, you're more psychologically hardy just because of your inbuilt temperament, you might actually go, okay, great, I'll go, see you later, right? But if you're a bit more sensitive to that, or maybe you've really had this type of thing drummed into you, of course you're not going to go. You're going to have that, you're going to think, I have to go. I've got to take care of mum, or I've got to take care of dad, or I've got to help mum with the siblings, or whatever it is. So, you know, the guilt-inducing parent or critic mode is one that a lot of people have. Dare I say, I know this is a stereotypical generalization, but a lot of women have it, okay? Also men, but just sociologically speaking and psychologically speaking, because of our upbringing and our grooming and all this, that, and the other, a lot of women have it. And a lot of women who go into the helping professions have it as well. So it can be very hard to say no, how it manifests in adulthood. It's very hard to set boundaries. It's very hard to say no when you want to say no. So you end up saying yes because, well, you have to say yes in the moment because that makes you a good girl, right? Or a good person to say yes. But really, you don't want to say yes for whatever valid reason. But you find that you're saying yes. Then you wonder why you got that migraine the next day. or that chronic pain condition's just flared up in your lower back. You're wondering why you've got that. Well, it's just because the subjugation's gone into your body, made you tense up all your muscles, and come out as somatic distress. That's why you've got it. Because you really wanted to say no, and no was legitimate and justified, but because of your schemas and because of this guilt-inducing critic mode, you've said yes. And then you get aches and pains and your irritable bowel flares up or whatever it is, and whatever your flavor of psychosomatic, you know, real conditions, but stress exacerbated conditions flares up. And so you wonder why you're going to the doctor so many times. When we chronically subjugate in contact with others, so when we deny what we really want to do or what we really want to say or the outcome we actually really want, when we suppress how we really feel, ultimately this is either very depressogenic, leading to perhaps a depression, or this is very harsh on the body and comes out in a lot of somatic complaints, or we just get full of resentment and we end up, you know, the pendulum swings. So one day someone asks us, oh, Sarah, would you like to make some cupcakes for the, you know, Mother's Day stall? And you've just been saying yes when you really wanted to say no for the last, you know, 40 years, and you lose it and fly off the handle. I've seen people do that because the pendulum just swung the other way and now they just can't bear to be asked anything because they've never set healthy boundaries. They've never had a firm boundary with others. It's always been fuzzy. They've always been the one to pick up the slack, either because it feels good in the moment and they get a reward, and it also reinforces their schemas, so, you know, they're not about to change anytime soon. And then it's the straw that breaks the camel's back and they swing the other way and everybody goes, God, what's wrong with her? You know, she has lost it. And that kind of thing happens. I've seen people quit their jobs, leave their marriages, go ape at their kids, pack in their job, like I said, leave friendships, bust up friendships that were sort of pretty okay, at least that they just had a few boundaries in there, people might treat them better, or they might recognize people who are taking advantage of them and get rid of them as friends. So, you know, the guilt-inducing critic is a long way of saying that it can be pretty toxic as well. We know it's there if we're feeling guilt for no good reason, and it's pretty tied with self-sacrifice and subjugation schemas, which clinically I see co-occurring a lot. Yes, they're different schemas. They're often driven by a different emotional set. There's often a lot of guilt in the self-sacrifice schema, and there can be a lot of fear in the subjugation schema, but they're inherently forms of subjugation. They fall under sort of the same umbrella of basically suppressing yourself, self-suppression. And self-suppression can work short-term, but it doesn't really go so well long-term. So problems start kicking in if we use it as a long-term way in life, a strategy in life. So it can be really hard to break the processes of the guilt-inducing critic because we feel really bad if we put ourselves first in an instance, right? If we just do what we really want to do, you know, if we set a boundary with someone, if we set a boundary with our children, you know, a healthy boundary, but a boundary nonetheless. If we set a boundary with a friend who's overstepping the mark, you know, these things be very hard and you have to be very courageous, you know, and really lean into it and practice a lot of opposite action and, you know, feel the guilt and do it anyway. And because not all guilt is valid. A lot of guilt is not valid, right? So some guilt is very valid, but some guilt isn't. So, you know, we have to be able to differentiate that. If we've got a guilt-inducing critic, it seems to be we'll feel bad if we don't do that, or we'll have a monologue that sort of says, oh, look, you're not much of a parent if you don't. What kind of a parent are you there? Or what kind of a partner are you if you do that? Or, you know, what kind of a friend are you or a sibling if you do this? You're not being good enough. You're not helping others. It's your mission in life. Mother Teresa, you've dropped your standards. So we can feel very guilty if we're not always meeting the needs of others. And if this is the case, on repeat, you probably have an entrenched guilt-inducing critic. I hope that has helped you identify, and you maybe you have a different critic. Maybe you've heard me talk about these and say, no, I've got something else, totally different. And in that case, we would love to hear about it. So send us an email at justineandgemma@goodmood.com.au and we would love to hear about it. Critics can be changed. That's the message that I would like you to get. They can be modified. Sometimes we really want to dilute them to the point where they're nothing. Other times we might want to shift them and see, can they be molded into something more useful, right? Or do I have to really, you know, is this critic so deep that I have to do some deeper work and really get to the core of it and change it at the level of a child mode, right? Do I really have to do some very deep reparenting there and change some really deeply held beliefs and stories that I have? So I hope this has helped you get a little bit of distance and perspective from your critic. And information is power, really. The more information we have, the more switched on we are, the more aware we are. And we can start to just differentiate what our thoughts are actually saying and doing. And that old story again, that's getting a bit boring now. So we can start to think about and change our relationship with our thoughts and start to look at our thoughts rather than looking, you know, looking from them, being completely fused with them all the time. Go to our website and have a look. It's goodmood.com.au. And over the next coming months, we are introducing a few other services. And we're going to start to talk a little bit about some schema coaching that we will be offering, which will be useful in terms of anybody wanting to really put their critic under the microscope and having a look at what it says and where it's from and how can we begin to destabilize it and change it so you can stop self-sabotaging and actually get rid of the self-defeat and actually live the life that you really want to be living. So that's why I love schema therapy so much, because there's a label for everything. I mean, a good label. I don't mean like just a negative, like you've got this condition, see you later, all the best. I mean, it's a helpful label, a label to help us understand parts of ourselves. And are they healthy parts? Are they, you know, coping modes? Am I coping in this maladaptive way and I need to do something else? And that's maintaining my problem. We've got a way of describing pretty much everything we do in schema therapy. So it's very, very useful to even to have a schema therapy conceptualization of the current problems in your life now can be very illuminating. It's a new way of looking and shedding light on what's going on if we can look at our issues from a schema perspective, because there's always something we can do. That's the message I want to give you. There's always something we can do. There's always progress we can make. And there's always gains we can make, and there's always things we can change. There's always parts we can heal, and we don't have to be stuck with anything. You know, for life, we can always tap in to other parts that are just waiting to be elaborated and burgeoned and are waiting to grow. But, you know, if we could get rid of these critics or, you know, quiet them down a little bit so that we have other parts of us that can actually bloom and blossom, particularly our creativity. But it's so hard to be creative when you've got an inner critic, because that critic is going to be so judgmental. But if we don't have the critic and we just replace that with a compassionate voice, yes, it's not, I know it sounds easy, but I'm, you know, it is doable. That's the message I'm giving you. If we replace that with a healthier, compassionate voice, then we hold things a little more lightly. We can take the risks because we know our critic's not going to be there to beat us up if we don't go so well. We can have the energy and the enthusiasm to be creative, to put energy into a creative pursuit or something that we're doing or writing or painting or that new job we want to start up. You know, we can take these risks because we've rejigged and shaped and modified or changed, you know, that critic. So if you want to get in touch with us, yes, it's justineandgemma@goodmood.com.au. And very soon we will be announcing some exciting things that we have in store. because you know about our Red Flag Project for Women, which is an online course for women who find themselves repeatedly getting involved with male partners who are not available, emotionally unavailable, or controlling or narcissistic. And that's the course for that, the Red Flag Project. You'll see it in the show notes at the bottom. There'll be a direct link to that page, so you can check that out if you haven't already. Justine and I are working on a whole new website for the Red Flag Project and that mission. And that's a niche that we have. We don't only serve that population, but it's a very important one that we are now at the moment putting a lot of energy into. There's going to be a lot of exciting stuff on there. There's going to be some free resources. There'll be some webinars, some other courses that we're working on. I know a lot of you have been raised by one or more narcissistic parents, and we're working on a course all about that, because that's been really some of our most popular shows when we've spoken about narcissism and the narcissistic parent, which can be a challenge in life to no end. So, you know, there is lots coming, and we will keep you in the loop about absolutely everything. If you want to send us an email or if you want to get in touch with us, please do so. And thank you so much for listening, and we really appreciate it. And we've had some lovely comments from our listeners, and we really value what we do, and it's important for us to provide you with some new and different ways to think about your life and the people. Thanks so much for listening today. If you enjoyed this episode, we'd love for you to share it with others. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast to get notifications when new shows are released. You can visit us at goodmood.com.au/podcast for more information. You know, this podcast is intended for learning and entertainment purposes, and we really hope it achieves that. But because it's not a substitute for personal therapy, we'd like you to consult a qualified mental health professional for tailored support. Bye for now.